I've been down roads from Churchill to L.A. Met kings of speed and stars along the way. They got stories that the cameras never show. Yeah, the truth behind the fame is what we know. From the saddle to the silver screen glow, fast lanes and punch lines on a late night show. You think you've seen it all, but you don't know the half till the curtain lifts and we all have a laugh. It's not just who they are, it's how they came to be. A little horsepower, a little mystery. It's Hollywood and horsepower, baby. Take a ride where the legends laugh and the engines never hide. From the track to the spotlight, stories unwind. Yeah, the truth's a little wild and one of a kind. Hollywood and horsepower, where the real ones show. Every twist and turn is a tale you didn't know. So pour a drink, sit back, enjoy the show. Where the fast and famous let it all go.
Welcome to the Hollywood and Horsepower Show. I'm your host, Mark Otto. We are the show that brings you the story behind the story, brought to you today by Tony's Steak and Seafood. Tony always says there's room at his table for one more. I always say dining at Tony's is an experience, not just dinner. You owe it to yourself to go. We are joined today by a very special guest, introduced to me by a very good friend of this show, Michael Blowen. Frank Santarelli, most people will probably know him from The Sopranos. A lot of people in New England and on the East Coast are going to know him best for his comedy. And really, if you followed him like I have, you know him for a lot of different things. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's great to be here in Texas.
It's an honor to have you. I mean, you are a legend in so many different ways. You're one of the rare guys in our industry that not only has worked for way more things than people are probably even aware of, but you're kind of well known for several different things, to me at least. I mean, to me, yeah. And I think most people see you immediately think of something, but I don't think it's always the same thing. Is that fair?
Yeah. A guy came up to me at Reno Airport, and he goes, "Are you Frank Santarelli?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he goes, "You're in the Godfathers of Comedy." I said, "Yes, I am." He goes, "I just saw you on Conan O'Brien the other day." I said, "Yes, I was." He goes, "I saw you in a commercial for A1 Steakhouse." I said, "Buddy, you watch way too much television."
You'll be discharged.
I mean, I do it all. I do it all. I do commercials, TV shows, movies, whatever you need me to do. I want to host cruise the ships. Oscars.
Oh, yeah. I no question ships. You will at some point.
Yeah, right. That would be great. I would love to.
I mean, you're known from the improv, which, you know, for anybody who loves comedy, and, you know, if anybody listens to this show knows, I'm a huge fan and follower of comedy. I've always loved comedy. I've wrote a lot. I've never, you know, I'm not the guy behind the mic like you. I'm the guy that's behind the curtain, feed, you know, sure, sliding things under the curtain to you.
Sure.
But I have so much respect for it. And I love, you know, one of the things that we want to work on this show, and we're going to do a series on, is like history. And I'd like to definitely have you be part of that. But,
absolutely.
You know, did you start out more in acting or more in comedy? Or
oh, writing? Yeah. No, I was, it's kind of a tie. What happened is I was always the class clown. And even as a young kid, I would make my parents laugh. And I'd say, "Watch, I'm going to walk like Mr. Wilson." And, you know, the guy across the street, he walked funny. And I could walk like him. And I knew everybody would laugh at that. So, but my real beginning was stage theater. My first thing I ever did was I was an Oreo guard in The Wizard of Oz. You know, those Oreo, so one of those,
yeah,
guys?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, I was an Oreo. That was the first thing I was ever in that was organized. And it was the ninth grade play. And so, yeah, the guy asked me, can you get some of your football player buddies to come down here to be them? And that's who was the rest of the Oreo guard, was the guys on my the offensive and defensive lines.
On the biggest Oompa Loompas in history.
You need the biggest the biggest guys to be the Oreo guard. You know, those guys. The guards to the gates where the Wicked Witch was.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
No, you know, and it's amazing how those things start. And you touched on something. It's like, you know, you talk about, you know, the class clown doing things at home. I was the same way. And I think, it's funny. My mom was my biggest victim. Everything I tested out on my mom, and then I'd use it at school. Sure. She was like the test tank. But it was. And I remember the most common response I would get is she would just kind of look at me with that blank stare and go, "You're not right." You know, and kind of go off and do what she was doing.
Yeah.
I think all of us kind of had that thing. So when did you do your first stand up?
Yeah, that was in like 1981. So it was like 6 years, 5 years after I graduated from high school. Wow. I was living in New York City. I was taking acting classes, and I thought I wanted to be the next Robert De Niro.
Sure.
And then I got sort of sidetracked into this comedy thing. A friend of mine said, "You got to go down there." So we went down there, and I won the open mic night.
Was that at the Improv?
No, this was in Cleveland at the Cleveland Comedy Club.
Oh, Cleveland. Okay, I didn't know if you meant.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I started in Cleveland, and so I won the contest.
Wow.
And but none of them were professionals. They were all open mic guys.
Sure, it's open mic. Yeah, a bunch
it's
of guys.
It's open
working.
Mic, exactly. And so anyway, I beat all these guys, and then I won again. Then I won again. I won like 4 weeks in a row, and they put me in the regular shows there. Now, that was, you know, just me doing Sunday night open mic night. I had never been on stage before as a real professional comedian, just goofing around at these open mics. So anyway, I went up, and that's how I started. I started doing comedy in Cleveland, and I just missed Drew Carey. Drew Carey had just taken off and moved to L.A.
Oh, wow.
I just missed him, like literally by one Sunday. And he was gone. And that was that. And so anyway, I started
working
there.
That was kind of his home club.
It was.
Okay.
And then he became Drew Carey. You know, he did very well for himself.
No, he did very well.
He got a shot on the Tonight Show.
He always loved Cleveland.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a Cleveland guy. You know, I make jokes about it all the time. I go, you know, I'm friends with Drew Carey. And he makes $12 million a year. I'm in the back of a pizza shop in Saugus.
Working for a slice.
Right, exactly. So anyway, yeah, that's how I started in comedy, and then I started branching out. I worked the Pittsburgh Funny Bone, and I worked Zany's.
Absolutely.
In Chicago, and all these clubs, these fine clubs that were happening right around 80, 83, 84, 85. Then I moved to Boston in 1985. Because the comedy scene was exploding.
Explode, yes. They were legendary.
Seven comedy clubs, yes. It was insane. Everybody had a one-nighter somewhere. So we were working absolutely five, six nights a week, getting paid. And it was insane.
Which was huge, because for people that are just joining us, I'm with Frank Santorelli, well-known comedian, writer, actor. You know, when you start talking about some of these things, you know, some of the things in comedy world, I think a lot of people don't realize how hard it is for people to get started. I know from different comedians that I know, like, they would work their tail off six, seven nights a week and barely make enough to cover just their running around the city and buying.
That's right. No, you don't make any money when you're trying to break in. You don't make any money. There's no money to be made doing a guest spot here and there.
Yeah, you felt pretty good if you just covered.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, one place, the Catch in Cambridge Catch Rising Star in Cambridge would pay $20 on Sunday and $25 on Monday. Those were the two open mic nights they had. So you can make $45 doing an open mic. Now, I was making money as a regular comedian, and I was in the rotation. You know, I was working big time. I was working everywhere, from Gloucester, Mass. To Providence, Rhode Island, you name it. I was doing 30,000 miles a year.
Wow. So absolutely. At this point, you were already headlining, or were you like a middle act?
No, not exactly. You know, I was trying to break into headlining. I was trying to,
sure.
You know, you needed 45 minutes. And, I only had half an hour, maybe 40 tops. If I'm really struggling, that's struggling through 45 minutes. But, yeah, you know, you got to establish yourself as someone that can close the show and do better than the other two comedians. And that's hard to do.
I know a lot of people don't realize that, you know, there's like an opener, a middle, and a closer. And it's like those are, you know, and they're very selective on who they put in those slots.
Yeah,
you know, it's tough to get a spot. I remember Judd Apatow said he felt like he made all the movies he made just to get a good spot at the Improv. It was so hard to get in there.
That's really funny. Yeah, he's a funny guy.
He is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you go on from there. What was the first acting role you received?
The first acting role, like I said, was that play in high school, but. Professionally, it wasn't until like 1986 when I got a real manager and a real agent from doing stand-up in New York. Now, they would sit and watch comedians, managers.
They're looking
and
for new guys to grab.
Absolutely. And so they pounced on me at Stand Up New York, it was called. It was off of Broadway there on like 86th Street. And it's still there. It's called Stand Up New York. And so anyway, a guy came up to me and said, "Do you have a manager and an agent?" And I said, "No." And he said, "I can be both." And so anyway, one of the first acting jobs I ever got was a commercial. It was for the Omni Biltmore in Providence, Rhode Island.
Oh, wow.
And they were farming out the work in New York. So anyway, I got it. It was a chef. I was a chef, and so I had to wear three different outfits. The first acting work I ever got was on a show called Providence.
Oh, yeah.
Believe it or not. Yeah.
No, very well-known show.
Yeah. With Melina Konokarides was her name. And so, yeah. Well, actually, there was a movie before that, but it was nothing. It didn't do anything. It was called Crooked Lines.
Oh,
you're not
going to
believe who you saw that?
I saw it because I was researching you and
I
looked it up.
You know who's in that? Is David, what's his name? The lead singer for the New York Dolls. David Johansen.
Oh, wow.
Is in that movie.
Before he was David Johansen.
Well, he was already David Johansen. He had already left. Them.
Okay.
So he was in a movie career. He was trying to do a movie career. So anyway, he plays like a drunk guy standing on a street corner.
Which kind of brings us to one of the things that you're known for, and I was told you know where I'm going. I'm just gonna lay this down and step away like Miller would. Is like it's said that you're like the best drunk since Foster Brooks. A couple of people said probably better than Foster Brooks.
That's true. That is true. I do a really good
job. Which is high praise.
I know, man.
Foster Brooks is a legend.
Oh, my God. He was hilarious. Mother of God. He would come on the screen and he was electrifying. He was
funny. My best, the best bits of his were the ones that he did on the Dean Martin roast. I mean, he did a lot of good ones, but like that one of him being Bob Hope's pilot was hysterical. I mean, I've watched that probably 20 times and I still laugh every single time.
Absolutely. No, he was wonderful. And I heard he never drank.
No.
Someone said he never drank. I was like, you gotta be kidding me.
No,
right?
Well, Michael Blowen, mutual friend of ours, Michael.
Oh, yeah, Michael Blowen, yeah.
Yeah. Dean Martin didn't drink a lot. I mean, it's not gonna say he didn't drink, but he didn't
drink like they
thought he did.
No, you're right.
And the reason was Michael said he always had a standing tea time the next morning, so he was pretty adamant about his golf.
Yes, and he went up against Frank Sinatra. He was the only guy that could tell Frank Sinatra no, And Frank would say, listen, we're going out tonight. He would say, no, I'm going home. I got a tea time at 6 a.m. I can't go.
And I heard that was actually Frank would be a rub mad. Between them. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Frank would be really furious. And Dean was like, no, I have to golf tomorrow. You can come with us golfing, but you ain't going to make it staying out till 4 o'clock in the morning. I'll tell you right now. You know.
No, not when you go to bed at 5. You know, it's sure, like, and sure. That was Frank. You know, he was almost nocturnal from everybody I've
oh
talked to.
Oh, my God.
Close
he was like
him.
A vampire, that guy. Yeah, no, he was.
And he would just go hard on very little sleep. They said, so Tom Selleck tells a story about talking about, you know, just this point that it Frank did not take it well if you didn't hang with the boys. And
yeah.
I guess one night he was with him. And it was going pretty late, and he had an early flight to get back somewhere, probably when he was doing Magnum. And he goes to stand up, and he always called him Moose, and he says, where are you going, Moose? And he's like, I got an early flight. He goes, sit down. So he said he just sat back down. He says we were there for like another 3 hours.
Sure. Yeah, so I started at the Cleveland.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I started at the Cleveland Comedy Club. Then I moved to Boston. Like 4 years later, in 1985, a friend of mine convinced me to move to Boston. He said, you got to come here. There's a million one-nighters. There's colleges. There's 7 comedy clubs. There was Stitches. There was the Comedy Connection at the Charles Playhouse, the one at the Faneuil Hall.
And everybody went through there. I mean, you know, they had some
everybody,
big headliners
everybody.
Come
no,
through
you're
there.
Absolutely right. All the comedians of the day would come to Boston to work. They
absolutely.
Could actually come here and work. And that's opposed to L.A. and San Francisco and New York are showcase places.
Yeah, put your name on the list and hope.
You're hoping someone's going to see you for something. As opposed to Boston, which is a place where they need someone to close the show here. They need a headliner, someone that's going to be able to be really funny here at the end. So it's not a showcase. It's a
which people don't realize that's a tough slot because
absolutely.
You're you know if you got a guy that goes in front of you that levitates the room, that's
yeah,
and then, you know then you're the guy next up. I mean that's kind of like forgetting your bag at 27F and crawling back against the crowd to get it. I mean everybody's headed out.
No, you're right. The guy in the middle is always trying to blow the headliner off the stage. And, you know, every opener is trying to blow the middle act off the stage. And so that's the idea. You know, you want to become a headliner, so you want to do as good as you can. And so they're always coming gunning for you. When you're the headliner, they're always like, I'm going to be funnier than this guy, which is good for the show.
And some guys are just naturally, you know, Dennis Miller, they said, before he really people figured out who he was, in Southern California, they said he would do that. He'd be like a, you know, opener or sometimes even a middle. And the people that followed him were like, what's going on? The crowd's like,
oh, yeah.
They're not.
He's really good. No, he's good. Right.
And then somebody said, I walked out there and watched him. And it's like, Jesus, I'm following this guy.
Right.
He's levitating the room.
Absolutely. No, you're right. These guys, they kill and they're dirty. They're amazingly dirty, and that hurts.
And that was another thing that you have a really strong reputation for. You've always kept your act. You could play anywhere. You've kept your act pretty clean.
No, you're right.
And for anybody that doesn't know, and I remember Jerry Seinfeld saying this, you know, it's easy to throw something out there, drop an F-bomb or something, get a quick laugh, but it doesn't age well. You know, and it's,
that's right.
If you're really
going
to build an act, you know, you need to put some work into it. And I think that's the part that a lot of people don't realize is how much time goes into like writing and, you know, plan. You know, I remember Michael telling me that, you know, when he was in Boston with the Globe, one night he went down and Chris Rock showed up really late and just worked on new material for several hours over and over, moving the line, coming back out, running another set. And he said that was when he really realized how much writing went into it because it
right.
was so much, you know, and I know the guys I've talked to for like Saturday night, that was a big deal. They're like, you know, the things that they looked for in a new guy was writing. If a guy
right.
could write, the rest would fall into place.
Yeah. Michael
so
and I became
Boston.
Friends. Yeah, Michael and I became friends when he started writing stories about me in the Globe. He was like my own personal little writer. he would write stories about me. Yeah, and so, you know, he started hiring me to work out in Kentucky.
Oh, wow.
And one time I opened up, you ready for this? I opened up for the Walendas, the highway.
Oh, I remember them when they came there. So years ago, at Michael's farm that he went, well, the reason he went to Kentucky, the old friend's farm, they had a horse named Walenda after those. Somebody named it after those people.
Yes. And so I opened up for them, and it was interesting because there was a ton of people there, about 1,000 people there outside. And they watched them ride their bicycles back and forth on that cord. And it was very uneventful because they were so perfect. Like, they didn't look like they were going to fall.
Yes.
So no one said a word. Everyone just went, oh, that's it? They went, yes. It was so uneventful because it was perfect. Nothing
went
wrong.
Didn't use it once.
So it didn't really shock anybody or scare anybody. You know what I'm saying? It didn't really it didn't really grab you because they were so perfect.
It was too good.
It was too good, exactly. Anyway, I open up for the Walendas. I tell people all the time. And they go, the High Wire Act? I go, yeah. It was, and I did it in Midway, Kentucky. And they go,
absolutely.
Midway? Yeah. I love Michael Bond.
Which is midway between two civilization points, Louisville and Lexington.
Yeah, I love Michael Blown. He's a great guy.
He is a great guy. And I think for people that don't realize the time period, this is pre-internet, and this is, you know, when the Boston Globe, New York Times, and L.A. Times were kind of like the 3 points of reviews. You needed good reviews from those three guys.
Yes.
If you were an act. You know, and at that time, like Boston and Chicago were really, really hot for building guys' careers.
Yes.
You know, they were either in the clubs in Boston doing the colleges or their second city in downtown in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, did you ever get through Second City? Did you ever do that at all?
No, you know, I never auditioned for any of those things. Never had the time or, you know, I don't know. I don't know why I never really.
Well, yeah, but if you're getting booked, you're not going to go that route.
You know, I was always getting booked. No, you're right. And it's to take time off and, I don't know. I just never got a chance to do it.
Did you ever get a chance to
do Chicago or, no, never did anything.
Saturday
like
night, did you ever go after
them?
Nope,
never did never. SNL. Never did an audition for them. Yeah, it's interesting. I was just
and
a pure stand-up and an actor.
And then, you know, you kind of go on more, you know, as time goes on. Like, when you started acting, were you still doing a lot of stand-up, or did it kind of consume your time?
Okay. Oh, absolutely.
So
you're
doing dates.
Absolutely. I was still.
Frank?
Hello?
Hey, are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Okay, sorry. It cut out for a second. I thought we lost
you. Yeah, yeah.
No, so you're still doing dates when you start acting, which I know a lot of guys do. Like if you were on site somewhere or on a set somewhere, would you go out and do, you know, sets on off nights and things like that?
It would kind of mess me up a little bit. Because, you know, television acting and movie acting is not an exact science at all. And
no.
So when they tell you to be on the set at 5:30 in the morning, and they don't use you for 12 hours, but you're getting paid to be there, but 12 hours later, they still haven't used you. And so you go, hey, man, I got a show tonight at 9 o'clock, and so I would have to sort of nudge them into shooting my scene. Oh, yeah. Definitely many times it crossed over. And a lot of times there's a lot of stress involved because of that. Just because it's so inexact, that's all.
And, you know, for people that don't understand, you know, we're joined by Frank Santorelli and talking about comedy and his acting career. You know, you're doing, you know, your stand-up and openers and things, but then you've also got, you're starting to act, but you really don't want to give up either one at this point in your career because you need the stand-up. Because the stand-up at this point had to be the one paying the bills.
Yeah, absolutely. And Yeah, they obviously the TV and movie stuff is so much more than the stand-up.
But there's gaps.
Absolutely. There's, you know, they very rarely run into each other.
Yeah, exactly. So you do, like, you know, you've done Spin City and, you know, a lot of other Las Vegas. At what point was it that, how did you come to get in front of the people on The Sopranos? Did you audition?
I just literally went to it. It was just an audition that I went to. It was that simple. At that time, I would do 4 or 5 auditions a month.
Okay.
And so I went in and I read for, they said they're looking for a bouncer for The Sopranos, a thing called The Sopranos. And I thought to myself at the time, well, that's kind of a dumb name. And then when you think about it, the Beatles is a dumb name, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You never know.
When you don't know what the project is, you have to be thinking, is this like
right.
the boys' choir?
Right, the Sopranos, what is... you know, what could that possibly be? And so I didn't think anything of it. And I went in and read in front of Georgiana Walken, who's the casting director, who's Christopher Walken's wife.
Oh, wow.
Her name is, Georgiana Walken, and she has a casting agency. Walken Jaffe Casting. And so I walk in and I read, and the lines are, hello, 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 hello. I'm not kidding. Like 15 hellos in a row. Hello, hello. And then I look at him and I go, it's a menu. And then I look back at the phone, hello, hello. And then he beats me with the phone because he's so mad that I'm saying hello so many times.
So who was it that worked across from you when you were reading?
Well, it was, I think James Gandolfini was there. I can't remember for sure because I didn't really know who he was. And I'm not kidding.
Sure. Nobody would have.
I knew he was in a civil action with Vinny Barbarino, John Travolta.
And I think he had done Get Shorty at that point with Travolta.
Yeah,
right?
He had done small parts here and there, but nobody knew who he was.
No.
And
no,
anyway, I think he was there. I think Paulie Walnuts was there.
Okay.
And then there were a few assorted other people.
So
now, television and movies are a visual medium first. So I look like a bouncer, absolutely. And they're not looking for a bartender because they don't use male bartenders in a strip club for men. They use female bartenders. So I was a bar back, really, a guy that just makes sure there's ice, nobody messes with the strippers, you know, sort of bus tables and stuff. So, no, I was not a bartender, even though that's what they call me. I go, okay, fine. I was the bartender on The Sopranos. That's really going to stick. That's not going to change.
And they used the phone on you in the read.
Oh, yeah. They hit me with a phone, and it was fake. It was made of rubber. And it was a real phone. It really looked like a phone, too. It was hilarious.
And we did about 20 days. So you kind of knew going in, this has got an end to it.
Yeah, I had I got stunt pay. They actually asked me if I wanted a stand-in. And I said no, and they said, okay, well, sign here, please. You're getting stunt pay. And I go, really? And they go, yeah. Isn't that hilarious? I got stunt pay because I actually fell onto the ground. So they had it all padded up with mattresses and rubber foaming all over the corners and everything, so that when I fell, it was like I was falling into a powdered donut. There was no danger at all. But I got stunt pay. Yeah, and
how was it working with the cast? Did you like
it? Yeah, they were great. Everybody was nice. Everybody was really nice. Gandolfini was a dream. He was really nothing like that character at all.
No,
he was a really wonderful. He was a real wonderful guy, and very, very serious. And he was under a lot of pressure, so that when I worked with him, I couldn't really bust chops with him. There was no goofing around. He was all business. He had a million lines. He had a million lines to do. He really, really had the lion's share of the work. He's in most scenes. The show runs around him. And so he was under a lot of stress.
And if you watch it, there's a lot of acting in his role. I mean, he's got to work himself up. He's got to get, you know, every emotion you can think of, he's got to come up with for different scenes. From being absolutely outraged to being, you know, kind of chuckling to, you know, really stressed out, everything in between.
Yeah, he was fascinating to work with. He really was. He was, like I said, nothing like that character at all.
No, and you know, it's funny because, you know, you're Italian, I'm Italian. I grew up, you know, Detroit, and, you know, obviously we know that life. It's, you know, that's anybody who's Italian knows somebody. There, you got that uncle that keeps his hands in his pockets at the reunion. And, you know, it's so different to me. That was the one thing about the show that was kind of funny. I remember I talked to a guy that is in that life, and he made the comment. He's like, it's a great show. But he goes, I got to tell you, if a boss ever sat down with a shrink, that would be over before it started.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Admitting you have a fault.
Admitting you have a fault and talking about it with somebody else.
It was somebody else, exactly. No, you're right. That was bad.
But a terrific show. I mean, I know.
I
mean, and it was so gut-wrenching to see James go the way he did. I mean, I think everybody will love to see what he did next and what he went on to do.
Oh, I know.
Because he was so good at his craft. I mean, you could just
really
see that he really put a lot into what he did.
Yes. He was deadly serious about it too.
And, so what were some of the highlights while you were on that show? What were some of the high points for you? I mean, obviously working with Gamble.
Well, I was supposed to be only there for one day. So I was hired as a day player.
Okay.
Which means one day. So I was there literally 5 a.m. And in the makeup room, David Chase came in and said, put tattoos on this guy. And the girl, so the makeup person went, well, what do you mean? He said, just go crazy. Give him tattoos all over his arms and cut his sleeves off. I'm not kidding. This is what he says. This is David Chase, by the way.
Yeah.
And he's nobody at that time. This is the very beginning. And so he said, cut the sleeves off his shirt and give him big tattoos. So anyway, I made a character for myself. So I started taking bar naps and flipping them over my shoulder and wiping tables down and started kibitzing with the bartenders. There's like three of them there. And they're half naked. So it really was unsettling.
It's the Bada Bing Club. Yeah.
And the strippers were naked. It was very unsettling. And a lot of the crew were acting crazy because there was naked women around. It was unbelievable. And so, I just really started to make a little character for myself. And when I answered the phone, I didn't say some of the lines. I just motioned. I said, Tony, the phone's for you. He goes, is it that guy? And instead of saying, yes, it is, I didn't say anything. I just dipped my head and gave him the phone. And so the director's coming over to me, and he's saying things to me like, I like what you're doing. I like what you're doing. Keep doing that. Keep doing that. Keep cleaning.
Yeah.
Keep cleaning and keep kibitzing and keep moving. Don't stay in one spot. And I said, okay. So anyway, I built a little character for myself. And it took me all day to do it. I was balancing. I could balance things on my nose. So I was like balancing like chopsticks and stuff. And just basically being Goofy and Frank Santorelli. And so when the show was over, when the taping was over, I'm in the makeup room and they're going to take these tattoos off of me that took 5 hours to put them on. And I go, you know, I can leave them on, you know. She goes, you can? And I said, yeah. I said, I'm not working in an office building or any, nobody's going to see these. And I had huge, elaborate tattoos on both arms.
Sure.
That never changed. That never changed. And so anyway, I'm in there, and she's taking my face makeup off, which was a ton. And David Chase busts into the room and goes, take pictures of those tattoos. And the girl goes, excuse me? He goes, you heard me. Take pictures of those tattoos. Make sure you get good shots of those tattoos. He leaves. She goes, oh, my God. I go, what? Now, I'm such a rookie at the time. She goes, that means you're coming back.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
I said, it does? She says, oh, yeah. Why would he take pictures of them if they weren't thinking of having them put on again? Which is exactly what happened. So yeah. I'm in the very first three episodes of The Sopranos. And I was only supposed to be there for one day, and I ended up to be in 13 episodes.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was supposed to be literally one day. So I made myself a character on The Sopranos, literally, as I was going. I never got a contract. They would just say, you're in the next episode.
So you didn't know until, like, pretty much the end of this.
A week,
you know,
the week before. The week before.
Yeah, when it goes in the can, they'd say, hey, we're going to use you next week.
We're going to use you next week. We need you next week. And I'd say, okay. And I'd go to the read-through. Now, the read-through was a whole special thing where the entire cast would sit around a big, giant room with a big square setup. So it was all tables and chairs, but in a square. And each person would sit down according to their hierarchy. So the top first person on the table was David Chase, then it went Gandolfini, then it went Lorraine Bracco, then it went Edie Falco, like that. So wow. The top tier people, and each person would say their name and say who they are on the episode. This is real. This happened every single episode I was in. I went to the read-through. That's
Which,
what they call it.
To put in perspective, this is a new show. You know, you're talking the first few episodes. And,
right.
You know, you'd almost need that because, you know, nobody knows that this is Tony Soprano yet.
You know, well, it's he like, says, the David Chase makes a joke. He goes, my name is David Chase. I'm the executive producer of this show. And this show in no way depicts Italian Americans as they really are. And everybody laughed. Hi, I'm Jim Gandolfini. I play Tony. Hi, I'm Elaine Bracco. I play Dr. Melfi. Like that. Each person would go down. Now, I'm talking about 75 people, 80 wow. people, 90 people,
At
right down
point?
To the fucking, right down to the cleaning guy that says, you know, I'm the janitor. And that's it. Everybody says who they are. I got to my part, me, it was my turn. I'm Frank Sandra. I play Georgie.
At so what that was point it. Do you realize this is going to be big? This has legs.
At the Radio City Music Hall, they showed the first two episodes on the biggest screen I ever saw in my life. It was at the Radio City Music Hall movie theater.
That's so cool.
And they showed the first two episodes of The Sopranos in front of 5,000 people. Yeah, I was there. And it was spectacular. The crowd went crazy. They were laughing and screaming and cheering like you can't even believe it. I could not believe that it was electric.
And that's kind and of like you hey, this thing's going to be big.
This could be big. This could be really big. And the funniest scenes were Paulie Walnuts and Big Pussy getting coffee at the Starbucks in episode 2. And Paulie Walnuts goes, how did we not get out in front of this? They steal everything from us. Buffalo mozzarella. You know, coffee. He's hilariously funny. He just rips into the thievery that's gone on. He goes, we gave them the gift of our cuisine, the Italians. It's great. It's a wonderful scene. He just rips into Starbucks. Right.
That's hilarious.
I know.
You know, along that line, and it makes you wonder with Dave Chase, you know, making the comment, this is no way it depicts Italian-American life.
Right, which is a scream.
You know, you've probably heard that, you may have even talked, you know, Joe Piscopo. Joe always did the Sinatra impersonation on SNL. And he made the comment one time that he was either in the airport or on a plane, and a guy came up. You may have heard the same story. And he said, just this slab of beef comes up. This guy, just a monster of a guy. And he leans on his arm that's sitting on the armrest where he couldn't move. And, you know, back then, Joe was a pretty good guy. He's pretty built. And he basically pins him in the chair. And he says, Frank loves your act. And he walks away. So you wonder sometimes, you know, I know people watch these. You know, I know it is, you never know who's watching. You never know who's listening. But it is kind of funny how those go. And, you know, I mean, I think that was one of the things to me that made that series so, you know, addictive that you got pulled into it was a combination of drama and comedy and real, you know, family issues and every emotion possible. It wasn't just like, you know, all intense and drama, and it wasn't just comedy. So it was a really good mix. And the personalities were so strong. It was one of those ones where, you know, yeah, there's main characters, obviously, Tony Soprano and Rock, you know, everybody, but there was also a lot of different directions going at one time. So you've got stories inside the stories inside the stories, and I think that always makes for a great show. If you look at other shows that have been like that, you know, that was what they said was electric about the Friends series and Cheers. And some of the other ones that really went on forever was the fact that it wasn't just one or two characters. It really had all these levels.
Yes. And so anyway, they never even knew I was a comedian. Nobody ever asked. Michael Perioli, at the one time we were in a van together, goes, someone says you do stand-up. And I go, yes. And he never said another word. He never said, like, oh, wow, that's interesting. He just took a puff off his cigarette and looked in the other direction like, how the hell did this guy get this part? You know, nobody can figure it out.
Was there anybody else from comedy cast in any of those spots?
No. No, there wasn't.
So everybody else was more of a dramatic actor than...
Yeah, pretty much.
Comedic. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you could kind of give Gambolfini a little... You know, he had some. He had had some.
Oh yeah,
spots,
I know.
Like
he was funny.
Shorty.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
When funny. Bill Pantoliano goes, I was going to be an architect, and Gandolfini, without saying a word, he just stabs at his pasta and smirks, like, "Yeah, you were going to be an architect, all right." You know what I mean? It was just like, "Come on, were you kidding?" Yeah, it was just perfect.
So you go on from there, and another famous one is Meet the Parents. So you actually did get to work with De Niro.
No, you know what? I'm not in any scenes with De Niro.
Oh,
I'm only one scene with Ben Stiller.
I did get to meet him.
I got to meet him, which was nice.
Okay. He was on set when you were there?
Yeah. Yeah. And he was another one. He was all business. There was no, hey, how you doing? Good to see you. That kind of thing. It was just like, hi. That's all.
I've heard
it's kind
that
of an annoyance
more than one
to them.
Person.
It's kind of an annoyance to them. Like, I never once said to Gandolfini, hey, can we do a selfie? None of those people. I didn't do selfies to any of them. None of them. They were working.
You know,
it wasn't right for me to walk up and say, hey, can I take a picture with you?
It's funny you say that, because people say that to me all the time. They're always like, well, did you get a picture? I'm like, no. I said, you know, there's kind of funny. I feel like it's rude.
It's rude.
When somebody's working or, you know, if you're, if you're in a situation like at a restaurant or a meeting, I just don't feel comfortable asking. So I never do that either.
I've met a lot
of known people and I don't have pictures of it. And in today's day, I mean, I don't think a lot of people realize that that's just not something you do.
Correct. Yeah, I never once even thought of it until it was all over. I thought I should have got some pictures, but what the heck?
You know, the other one, there's a really famous story with De Niro working with Rickles. And I guess, and Rickles said he was like, you know, he was really, really serious. And everybody warned him. They're like, hey, don't screw around. He doesn't, don't.
Right.
You know, he really doesn't like it. And he said they were in some scene and Rickles slams his hand down and says, I can't work with this guy. All this mumbling and spitting. And he walked out and he said, De Niro just absolutely died laughing.
Oh, yeah. Rickles is on the set of Heat. And De Niro's done with the scene. And Rickles goes, yeah, that was pretty good. If that's the way you want to do it, I don't know.
Those guys that could get away with stuff like that that nobody else could.
Oh, he could do it all. He could get away with murder. Absolutely.
And he had such great stories. I mean, I loved his stories. You know, he'd go up to, like, you know, Billy Graham and catch him, you know, at some very, very high function and say, you know, Mr. Graham, if you could just say a little word for me to stop the shaking of my arm, I really appreciate it. In the meantime, he's got his arm twitching and he was. And the funny thing, Rickles, you know, you appreciate this. They claim he didn't write it. It was pretty much all from the hip. He had bits he memorized, but it was just he'd work the room.
Absolutely. No, he was great.
So when you're doing your stand up in Boston, and this is, you know, the heat of it. You know, I mean, this is, you know, 80s going into 90s. Did you cross paths with a lot of people that weren't known yet that went on to be huge? You had to.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Jay Leno came in the back at the Cleveland Comedy Club in 1981. Came in the back room of the Cleveland Comedy Club.
Wow.
And, I mean, he was mildly famous for opening up comedy clubs. Him and Jerry Seinfeld were opening up this brand new idea called the Comedy Club, which not a lot of people knew about at the time. And and so he came in the back. You know what he said to us? He goes, do you have anything in your act that doesn't get a laugh, but you think it's funny and you keep it in your act? And we all go like this, yeah. He goes, why? He got us with that.
He is hilarious, and he has that dry.
But he goes, why do you, far be it from me to tell 200 people, no, that's funny. Meanwhile, 200 people just didn't laugh at one of your jokes.
Well, and that's, you know, and that's a good point. It's one of the things I love about comedy. It's probably the truest form of instant feedback. I mean, I think a lot of people think, and I think this is what happens to a lot of guys, you know, when you first start out. You think, well, everybody's here. They're having fun. They're laughing. You know, I'm going to go up there and do, you know, just throw some stuff out. And you find out really quick, they're not laughing. You know, it gets really quiet really quick.
Exactly.
You know, it is, you know, you either make it or you don't. And I've heard it compared to the PGA. You qualify every week. It's like there's no, you're automatically in. And I think that's one of the things. To me, it's one of the toughest forms of entertainment because, you know, you've constantly have to be developing. And I know, like, Steve Martin made this comment when he quit. Everybody said, gosh, why'd you quit? He said, it took me 10 years to build this act. And it was a certain time in a certain place. And I could just see it was coming to an end. And he says, I didn't have another 10 years to put something else together.
Sure.
And it's, you know, like, people realize how hard it is.
Yeah. Rodney Dangerfield said, in 1960, I quit. And just to show you how my career was going, I was the only one that knew I quit.
Exactly. I think it was Rickles that said something like that. They're like, yeah. He's like, I quit for a while. And he's like, so you just told him you were done? And he goes, no. He goes, I quit. I just walked away. He goes, I don't know if they ever knew. He says, you know, you normally when you quit, you tell people. He said, I just walked away.
Sure.
So you still doing a lot of stand up today? You went on to do a lot of things after.
Oh yeah, no, I'm working a lot. I'm working Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday this week. Sorry, not tonight. Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
So how do you work on material? Are you constantly writing? I mean, obviously you have things that you probably have used for years that people just love.
Yes.
But you constantly have to be working on new material.
How
do you stay? What do you use to develop it, or what do you use to kind of build your act?
Well, what it is I have a good sense of humor.
Sure.
And that sounds pretty easy, but that's basically it. I can hear something and go, that's really funny, and remember it and write it down and that kind of thing.
I think that's a key piece too, is writing it down.
Yeah, and you got to write it down.
I've said that to people many, many times, because people always say, you know, where do you get material? And I say, you know what? Most important thing is, if it's funny to you, it's probably funny to somebody else. Write it down.
You got to write it down.
You'll play with it.
Right.
The other thing, now, do you collaborate with anybody? Do you do a lot of writing with other guys?
Actually, I don't. No, you know what? It's not the. It's just a.
Just single not your
person's
style.
Game. Yeah, it's just not done. Do you do your own stuff? And, you know, it used to be a different situation, but it's just not anymore. So, no, I don't get together with writing with other comedians. We just don't do that.
Probably, wouldn't you agree, it was probably back in, especially the 80s, early 90s, the clubs were such a community. You'd meet people and kind of feed off each other.
Yes. Oh, no, you know, Woody Allen used to talk about working in New York and with all the Borscht Belt guys and the people like that, and he would say, hey, man, try that joke this way and do the joke this way. There was a camaraderie. Not so much anymore. It's too singular. Everybody's trying to make it on their own, and they don't want any help, and they don't want... Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah, there's no camaraderie. It used
to
be.
It's kind of too bad we lost that, because a lot of guys
really... Yeah, I have a couple of friends I still talk to from time to time and stuff, and we will bounce ideas off each other, and I'll say something funny to them over the phone. There's a half a dozen guys I know like that. But we're not, no, we're pretty much on our own. We're our own, what do you call it, independent contract.
Now, I know you would have been kind of towards the tail end of his career, but did you ever get the chance to meet Carson?
No, I never met Johnny Carson.
Okay. Because they said that when you mentioned Woody Allen, it kind of reminded me of that, because they said that Carson was kind of like that. Like, if he had somebody on, or if he saw somebody and he would, and he got the chance, he'd say something to him on the side, you know, hey, maybe try this, or, you know, turn this way, give it a shot.
Absolutely.
Because he was another guy that really tried to help young comics. And, you know, I think, and I thought that was really cool. I mean, he had a reputation for doing that. Dennis Miller had a reputation for doing that.
Sure, sure.
I think that's really, you know, that's something that I hope people still will do stuff like that, because I agree with you. It's like, you know, it is kind of a community, and it definitely would be cool to keep it alive.
Sure, sure.
So do you still audition quite a bit, or are you still
interested in acting? I am auditioning, and I am coming very close to getting certain things. It's frustrating. I just auditioned for Dexter, the new Dexter.
Okay.
Which is called Resurrection, I believe. But anyway, I auditioned for that. Came very close. Sylvester Stallone's... what the hell is the name of that show?
Tulsa
King.
Yeah.
Auditioned for that, came very close to getting something there. And so, yeah, it's a, you know, it's frustrating, but at the same time, I'm still in the game. I'm very, very close to grabbing something.
Do you
All I
feel
want is
like
something
it,
regular.
Do you feel like, it, obviously The Sopranos helps you, but does it also create a block at times with something like
it
Tulsa
does.
King, because you're known for it as Georgie?
Well, first of all, it's been so long that it doesn't even come into contact anymore. I don't believe.
Okay.
Like, a lot of people, it's a visual medium first. So they were looking for a landlord. I could be a landlord very easily.
Absolutely.
They were looking for a bouncer. They were looking for a detective. So those are three things I could be. No, they don't go back and go, he did 13
He's
episodes of
this.
The Sopranos.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't really come into play. It might, you know, on a certain way, but a lot of these people are young that are auditioning.
Sure.
You know, they're 35 years old, and, you know, they were 10 when The Sopranos was on the air.
No, that's fair.
And they, and they don't care. They just don't care. They're looking for the guy that's perfect for this part. It's very, very singular focus.
And that's another thing that's kind of changed a little bit. It feels, which, of course, you know, if you go back, I mean, that would even been pre-Sopranos. You know, at a point there, we had, what, three or four networks, and that was most of the entertainment. So if somebody was on a very known show, it kind of hung with you longer, I think. And now, because of the amount of channels, it amazes me when you come across somebody that has never seen a known show. And right. I still do meet those people. You'll mention something to somebody.
Absolutely. No, you're
and
right.
They're like, oh, yeah, I've heard of it. I never really watched it. You're kind of like, what? I know.
So anyway,
no, I have to tell you, we're up at the top of the hour here, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. Where can people go if they want to see where you're going to be, future dates, projects you're working on? What's the best way for people to find you online? And
Frank Santarelli on Facebook.
Okay,
I'm on Facebook. Frank Santarelli on Facebook. That's it.
Frank Santarelli on Facebook. I know you're on other platforms, and you know, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
No problem, buddy.
You know, I can't thank you enough. It's been a pleasure, and I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Absolutely.
Hopefully we'll see you in the club somewhere soon.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Bye.
Well, folks, that brings us up to the top of the hour and, unfortunately, the end of our show. I don't think that's really necessary. But, you know, we really appreciate everybody joining us. There are two charities on this program that we support. OldFriendsEquine.org. You heard us talking about Michael Blowen. He was a former entertainment writer for the Boston Globe. His wife, Diane White, was a columnist with the Globe. They went on to start Old Friends Equine in Georgetown, Kentucky. Take a minute, take a look. If you can't do a lot, do what you can. They really, really do a lot of good work, not just for horses, but for people as well. The other one is No Fallen Heroes. No Fallen Heroes was started by Matt Wiz Buckley, a former naval aviator, Top Gun graduate, Top Gun instructor, what I always refer to as the real-life jester because he was an adversary instructor. Him and his wife, Susie, started a group called No Fallen Heroes that helps first responders, people, you know, that are coming out of the military and out of, you know, first responder life, and their families, not just the veterans themselves, you know, readjust to civilian life. We're losing way too many people to suicide today, and anybody that we can help, we really try to. So if you can't do a lot, do what you can. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us. This has been the Hollywood and Horsepower Show, brought to you by Tony's Steak and Seafood, and we will see you again next week.
So stay a while. You're in the driver's seat where the road and the rhythm finally meet.
Stick around. You never know who's next. And trust me, they got a story worth hearing.